Okay, this hour, while we continue chatting with Laird Scranton about his work seeking the primordial, the Velikovsky heresies, and so much more, we'll take your phone calls as well on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Laird Scranton with us, and his website is his name, lairdscranton.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. What's your next work, Laird? What are you doing next?
Well, that's a very good question. I have a book on Maori cosmology that's due out from Inner Traditions in May. It's called Decoding Maori Cosmology. The Maori are a tribal group from New Zealand that share a lot of the same elements as the traditions I've been exploring. It turns out practices and language that they use ties to every era and every region that I've written about.
Jeez. There we go again, right?
Yes. So I've had meant to write that book since the very first book, and I kept putting it off and putting it off. I kept getting bumped by other things. And now I'm glad that I did, because it ties to so many different other things.
Laird, do you think these visitations, assuming we had them, came from one group or many different ones?
It looks to me like there may have been more than one group involved. I think that the major thrust of the education for us cosmologically and civically, teaching us agriculture, looks like it was non-material, just like it looks as if UFO experiences may be non-material, and dimensional sort of non-material happening, not an off-planet thing. But it also is reasonable to think that we had off-planet visitations. There are so many planets out there that could potentially house life, and over the course of much longer spans of time than our world has, and there's no reason to think that some of those cultures haven't made it here.
With the amount of species on this planet, they must have had a frenzy when they came here.
Should have been many opportunities for them, and some of those may be problematic. How do you interfere with cultures? You know, Star Trek dealt with this. What do you do when you encounter another culture? Margaret Mead was the person who pointed out that every time in our history when a superior culture meets an inferior one or a less capable one, that bad things happen for the less capable one.
Did the humans of the time do a good job passing down the information of the things, the incredible things that had happened to their civilizations?
Interestingly, the ones that did the best job are the ones that never adopted a written language. And there's almost a macho in some of these tribes with oral traditions about not ever adopting a written language, that symbolism is seen to be a superior system to writing things down. There's something about writing a thing down that absolves a person from actually having to understand it.
Do they all seem to point towards a god?
No, actually, the Samkhya tradition is an expressly non-theistic tradition.
Really? Okay. Yeah.
Now, it evoked some other traditions that were theistic. But in the Dogon view and in the Samkhya view, while the concept is that the potential for life is built right in all the way up and down the scale of the levels of microcosm, macrocosm, and so forth, that and that some of the structures may actually be treated like living beings, that those beings are not deified. They're just treated eye to eye like us.
All right, to the phones now we go. West of the Rockies, Carl is in Arvada, Colorado. Welcome to the program, Carl. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much. Laird, what a great program. I wanted to mention I worked with Manly Palmer Hall at the Philosophical Research Society in Los Angeles. He spoke about Isis in a painting that was in the book. And underneath it says, "I am she who rises in the dog star. No mortal man has ever unveiled me."
Right.
Well, I am an astrologer, and I've never found a correlation between dogs and that fixed star Sirius, which is, of course, July the 4th, and the U.S. was born on that day.
Right.
So I wonder if that D-O-G has something to do with the Dogons.
Actually, there is a rationale for associating with an actual dog. The symbolism in this tradition gets very complicated very quickly, and so the people who put the system together provided a group of four-stage metaphors to help us line things up. Now, the one you're probably familiar with is water, fire, wind, and earth. If a reference has to do with water, it pertains to the very beginning stages of creation. If it has to do with earth, it pertains to the very ending stages, meaning the atom level. Water pertains to waves, earth to mass and matter. Well, there's one of those metaphors has to do with the animal kingdom, and it runs from insects to fish to four-legged animals to birds. Now, in the Dogon conception, the earth is considered to be the planet of the fishes, and their teachers are associated with the dog star. That's a way of saying to us, symbolically, based on these classifications, that we're not the least advanced on the scale of advancement of cultures, and that they aren't the most advanced, that the two of us are sitting sort of side by side in the middle of it, the middle of the scale. And that's the way I interpret the dog star reference.
Isn't your book, Seeking the Primordial, somewhat part of a process of creation?
My book really gets down to the essence of it. Part of the reason I rushed this book, I had asked Inner Traditions to fast track it. And one of the hard and fast rules in the publishing industry is not to publish two books by the same author at the same time. And so they
weren't able to. That's a no-no, right?
So I ended up publishing it myself, even though there's another book in process that sort of stood as an obstacle to getting this material out. But this is really the core of everything as far as I'm concerned.
Led, what would you say fascinated you the most when you were putting together this book?
Well, I began to see that the processes of creation look as if they are perfectly understandable, that there are only about three dynamics at the bottom that repeat themselves all the way up the scale, a fairly simple set of dynamics. And I thought, that goes completely against what any religion ever said. Then I began to study Shingon Buddhism, which talks about two forms of Buddhism. One is esoteric and one is exoteric. Now, in the Dogon culture, they fib about, the French anthropologists tell us that the Dogon priests fib about certain things to protect secrets. For example, their Sirius celebrations, their celebration of the Sirius stars, they say publicly it happens every 60 years. But in fact, after 50 years, they make an excuse to celebrate it early, quote-unquote early, mm-hmm. because the real number that they're celebrating is the 50-year orbital cycle of the stars, and they didn't want that to be obvious. Well, in Shingon Buddhism, they say that there's a fib being told between exoteric, the public version of Buddhism, and the private version of Buddhism. In the public version, it's represented that the processes of creation are fundamentally unknowable. But you get to the private version, and they say, oh, by the way, we fibbed. They're actually very knowable.
Do they get involved spiritually in any of the ancients? Have you noticed that they get involved with ghosts or anything like that?
Well, the structure that I'm describing in Seeking the Primordial offers a potential way for science to understand all of those things as real manifestations of things that could be studied scientifically. But you have to look at it in terms of the mind frame. There are scientific, traditional scientific stages of matter that point to the existence of this non-material realm. There's a class of particles that whose symmetry requires them to be turned around twice before they look the same. And one suggestion is that they pass into and out of this non-material realm. Now, one of the keys to my new book was sacred geometry. Sacred geometry begins with some geometry that's used to align a Buddhist shrine to north, south, east, and west.
Right.
And that geometry, it occurred to me finally to ask a question I had never heard asked. The question was, could this geometry be the geometry of something? As it turns out, it is. It's the geometry of that kind of particle that has to be turned around twice.
Good work, Laird. You've done some remarkable work here. Let's go to Melinda in Georgia, east of the Rockies. Hi, Melinda.
Hi, how are you?
Well, we're fine, thanks.
I'm enjoying this show. It is so interesting that I was able to get through. But
perfect.
What I want to say is, he's talking about my heritage. I was born in a family who had that energy situation going on, and we were, I'm black, so it was from the slave era,
mm-hmm.
that I wrote a book about it, Merit and Magic, and I explained things of what they taught me and how I'm able to use that energy even tonight to get to you on this phone.
Perfect.
To tell you about that he is telling the truth. Because my great-grandmother, my grandmother, all of them had that gift. And they would tell me when I was a little girl, they had so much to tell me, they would say, oh, don't worry, you'll remember it when it's time. I just have to tell you now. And I was taught so much. I was with them all the time. And my mother was psychic. Well, they didn't call it psychic or anything like that. They just knew they had this power, and right. they knew how to use it.
Right. Well, the first thing that a person learns in my field of study is that there are things going on that we can't immediately explain. And as soon as you start paying attention to those things, you tend to foster them. You tend to draw them towards yourself. I try to take each person's experience in their own framework. And I've seen people who seem to have very interesting connections all up and down a scale. To give you an example, there were case studies done of UFO abductees by a psychiatrist named John Mack.
And a darn good one. And yeah, Bud Hopkins, too.
Now, I had mentioned that there are clusters of meanings that go with these cosmological words. Well, there's actually seems to be dimensionality to those meanings. As an example, and the way it pertains to UFO incidents is, there's one incident where a woman steps out on her porch and she sees three gray aliens on a porch. They don't know that she's there. And after a bit, they notice that she's there and they turn to leave suddenly. But she doesn't see three gray aliens leave. She sees three deer leave. Well, in the Egyptian hieroglyphic language, the word that means to depart in haste also means deer. And so I started to get a sense that there might be a kind of a psychic dimensional connection here with a translation going on. And so I started paying attention to these case studies and discovered that time after time after time, what the experiencer is experiencing and what they're reporting having seen go together as multiple meanings of these cosmological words.
What do you think of crop formations? How do they tie?
The Dogon, actually, one of the symbols that they create to represent a stage of the formation of matter is just like a crop circle. My sense is, the first crop circle that was reported about 1500 A.D. It turns out that one of the effects that's reported is a high twittering sound that someone recorded and had analyzed, and it's at 15 kilohertz. Well, 15 kilohertz is the frequency at which biologists were trying to get plants to shake off bugs using flexural waves, and when the wave hit 15 kilohertz, the plant bends just like it does in a crop circle. This is a parlor trick. This is not, I mean, in terms of how it's accomplished, is not a mystery. It's an actual effect that happens with electromagnetism. But the shapes that are being created very often represent what I consider to be insider knowledge about cosmological shapes. So it looks to me as if someone who knows what they're talking about is creating those shapes.
Next up, let's go to Ray in Indianapolis. Hey, Ray, take it away.
Hi, hey, I'd like to reference this. You were talking about Moses in the Red Sea, and in the book of Jasher actually was a right-hand man for Moses, and you saw all the events, and he actually has a book of Jasher that was written as a missing book of the Bible, and it references the Red Sea and the fact that at midnight, the water recessed down, and there was actually a land mass, like a sandbar that went across that they crossed. And the book of Jasher is referenced in the Bible in 2 Samuel. And why Moses was actually fleeing was because apparently in the book of Jasher, he jacked the king or the emperor at that time and sold them a bill of goods, and they were trying to get away in haste. So it was actually, he didn't part it. They knew the time that when the water recessed down and there was a landmass at which him and his people could cross.
So you're saying there was a geological explanation for this?
Yes, sir. Yes.
I've heard that too. What do you think, Laird?
Well, I mean, we saw something very similar happen with the hurricanes down in Florida. I have a friend who has been visiting with us, and her boat, which was moored in Tampa, in the Tampa, Florida area, actually the water receded so far that the boat sat on the mud for hours, and then the water came back in and rose it back up. There are a number of different types of events that can happen that can cause that. We've seen it with tsunamis in Japan, water rushing out and then rushing back in. Velikovsky's mindset was that goes along with a number of other effects that are consistent with the close approach of an astronomical body, the eruption of Thera at about this, what he considered to be the same era, could have been a product of the same process. So, and many of the effects that were reported at the time of the Exodus, we saw downwind of the eruption of Mount St. Helens. Water that looked like it had turned to blood.
Right.
And vermin who abandoned water, bodies of water to get away, and boils on skin of people because of particles that fall on them. And so this is a set of known circumstances that go together with volcanic activity that could have been caused by that.
So you're saying, though, earthly explanations could be the cause for a lot of these biblical stories.
Right. Well, that's really the way that I see this whole thing from start to finish, that there is a scientific view here. The non-material aspect of it sits sort of like the blind spot in the mirrors of a car, that if you were a student learning to drive a car and your teacher didn't happen to mention to you about the blind spot, you might not figure it out for a long time that there's a space in there that your mirrors are not covering, that you can hide a tractor trailer in if it's positioned right. Well, the non-material realm, the way it's described in these ancient traditions, is like that. It sits in a space that modern scientific techniques for trying to identify things just don't touch.
Laird, where do we get your books?
Well, my publisher for the main series of books is Inner Traditions. So innertraditions.com is a good place to start. And they're associated with Simon & Schuster. So I also
on Amazon too, though, right?
Yes, I'm on Amazon also. The new book is available on Amazon in the United States and in the UK.
How about bookstores too? I love little bookstores.
Yes, there's within the next few weeks, the bookstores will have information about my book.
Great. Laird, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM with final phone calls. Those of you on hold, we'll get to you as quickly as we can. Don't forget, a couple little notes. Sign up for the free Coast Zone newsletter. You can do that by going to coasttocoastam.com. Like us on Facebook. If you're on Facebook, go like us on Facebook. You'll get a lot of information that way. Follow us on Twitter as well, where we send out little tweets, not quite as much as the president, but we send them out anyway. And speaking about criticalhealthnews.com, Doc Wallach will be our guest tomorrow for the first couple hours, giving you some health tips. And then, of course, Patty Greer joins us to talk about UFOs and crop formations. This is the UFO week this week. Things are happening. Our special guest here, Laird Scranton. His book, his latest one, is Seeking the Primordial, Exploring Root Concepts of Cosmological Creation. And as you were putting together this work and doing your research, Laird, and we talked about the Dogon tribe and the wonders of where they possibly got the information. Speculate on where the visitors went. Did they just come, tell them a few things, and take off? What do you think happened?
There are references in these cultures to, if you imagine, again, the cycle of scrolling energy as being a year. We're comparing this to yuga cycle concepts in Buddhism. There's a half cycle that's descending where the material universe is becoming more material, and a half cycle ascending, where the non-material universe is becoming less material, and there are eras in the middle there where it becomes possible to cross over one way or the other. The Dogon, one of the central themes of their mythology is something called the sacrifice of the Numo. The Numo were their teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that those who stayed beyond that last point where you cross back, it was a one-way trip for them. These are the groups that are represented as being short-statured in the UK and in Polynesia and Egypt and other places. And their fate in pretty much every locale they were in was to be hunted to extinction. This is part of the Maori book that will be coming out in May, is how the similarities that exist between the New Zealand short-statured people who I associate with the teachers and the short-statured people who are reported to have been in Ireland and forced out of Ireland.
Any reports of the craft that they might have been in?
Yes, only it's not represented in, like, an ancient Egyptian tradition and Dogon tradition. It's not represented so much as a craft as an evoked structure. In other words, electromagnetism, which is the essential energy of the non-material, was somehow employed, or seems to have been somehow employed, to create a kind of a gateway. These gateways, Buddhism talks about them. It's what's represented by the innermost chamber of any Buddhist temple, called the Garba, is an example of one of these gateways. And the idea is the gateways would allow passing over one way or the other. It's possible, in my view, although I don't have reason to argue it yet, that that's what pyramids are about. One of the things mm-hmm. they're about may have been about trying to perpetuate during eras when it started becoming more difficult to cross over between the universes, or that structures needed to get more complicated to allow us to do that.
What about sketches or drawings that might depict any of this?
There absolutely are sketches and drawings that depict concepts in both in Buddhism and in the Egyptian culture, this idea of being able to cross over from one place to the other.
To the phones now we go. Julian in Hemp Hill, Texas. Welcome to the show, Julian. Go ahead, sir.
Hey, George. I've got a question. Your other cosmologist, Don, had a call from a lady about 12.5 billion light years it takes for the light for the Big Bang to show up here. And Laird is a cosmology guy from particle physics and astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
The question I have is, he was trying to explain how the light was getting here. If the light was getting here from 12.5 to 13 billion years ago, how did we get here before the light?
Well, I don't think we did. Laird, we're not that old, are we?
No, we aren't. But if you imagine that your great-great-grandfather started on a migration from all across the other side of the world, and came here, and you were born in the United States, you could look back at the path that your great-great-grandfather had traversed in order to get here. You weren't here before he got here, but you could look back and see it. And that's sort of the concept, is that the formation of the universe happened over billions of years period of time, and as we use telescopes to look back, because of the length of time it takes light to get here, what we're actually seeing is the light that had left there billions of years ago. Now, one of the interesting effects...
And some of those stars could be burned out by now.
They could be. One of the interesting effects is the scientists can't figure out, as they look back into those prior realms and they do their calculations and measurements, it looks to them like the rate at which the universe is expanding is speeding up, and that confuses them. They can't explain it. But in the mindset of the tradition I'm talking about in my book, that's not what's happening. What's happening is, as the material universe becomes more massive, our time frame is slowing down. And so they're misunderstanding that they're seeing the effect of us getting slower, not it getting quicker.
We have Mary in New Jersey now. Welcome to the show. Hello, Mary.
Oh, hello. How's everybody?
You got a new governor tonight, too, I hear.
Yeah.
There you go.
That's good. Okay. I want to go back in the Bible. Jesus came down, and he took on humanity. He became truly human and truly God, fully human, fully God. The people that are in the Bible, like Melchizedek and the thief on the cross, I believe that those people were way, way, way back, even before Adam, and God clothed them in humanity. They were always human. They're not God. They're human. And that Jesus actually made him like space equipment, and they traveled through space. They're still human, but they get their power. They draw it from Christ because he gave them the power to do this. And I believe they went to the moon and exploded it, and that's where the water came down for Noah's Ark. And some of these people might have a remnant, they might be thinking back to Noah's Ark, where everybody came off and they all spread out and they have these memories. But there's other people who are up there with their spaceships.
All right, Laird, go ahead. I'd like you to get your reaction to some of that.
Well, there are researchers who think that there's somebody besides us on the moon. That right now would be difficult to prove because we haven't been back there for quite a while. I have reason to connect Jesus to the cosmology I'm studying because of certain symbols that were used to represent Jesus. There's the fish symbol, which
right.
scientifically is a representation of one of the ways that strings and string theory intersect themselves. It's also a shape that gets created by the sacred geometry as you're aligning a Buddha stupa. One of the residual figures that gets created is that same fish shape. Now, there's another symbol for Jesus, which was an X, which happens to also be another of the ways that strings intersect each other in string theory. There's a third, more complex way that strings intersect, and that's represented in the name of the goddess Neith. Her name, if you read the hieroglyphs conceptually, there are only three glyphs involved. It reads, her traditional role was to weave matter, and her name actually says, weaves matter, and it's followed by this complex picture of how matter is actually woven, according to string theorists. So I can see that somebody in the era of Jesus understood this same cosmological system because they were using the symbols of it in the right way. Beyond that, the Christian era is further removed from the tradition I'm studying than we are from the Christian era. It's 3,000 years from the Christian era back to where my stuff starts, and it's only 2,000 years ahead to us. So it's too far for me to make demonstrate a comprehensive connection to things. It's just too much time, too much potential for things to have changed, and not enough things were written down to be able to demonstrate it. But yeah, I can see that there were definitely connections to the same things I'm talking about.
Let's go to Darlene in Louisville, Kentucky now. Hello, Darlene. Go ahead.
How are you tonight or this morning?
Good. Thank you.
All right, good. The only thing I wanted to say was I'm not as educated as you two are, but when I was younger, I remember people saying that, you know, that's all the stars, these lights, you know, in the sky, there's got to be more than just one. I don't want to say human, but there's life on other planets and in other parts of the solar system. Because if you remember the little schismatic they have of the spiral, and we're right at the kind of at the end of it, what can you imagine is way out there, you know? And I do appreciate the information that you've given tonight, because I think I've learned something.
Thank you. I agree with you that it just doesn't seem believable that we would be the only intelligent life in even in this sector of the universe. That life is so tenacious, it's like weeds. I mean, if you ever tried to stop a weed from growing where you don't want it to grow, life looks like it's that way to me, that if the conditions are right for it,
it's everywhere.
Really get in the way of it.
And it's probably pretty similar too, Laird. I talked to my scientist before you came on, and he thinks that it's very possible it's all different. I think otherwise. As a matter of fact, some scientists came out just a few days ago and said that the life in the universe, the aliens could look very much like us.
Right. I believe that they could also. I'm also allowing for things quite different. I mean, octopuses look to me like they might not have originated here.
You never know. Let's go to Jack in Ferguson, Missouri. Hi, Jack. Good morning to you.
Hello, George. How are you doing?
Great, Jack. Thank you.
A long-time listener.
I am curious as to what your and good show, by the way.
Thank you.
What your guest has to say or his thoughts on the possibility of the moon itself being used as an alien base.
All right, and there are some that believe the moon was even towed into place, Laird.
Well, it is very interesting the ratios that play out in terms of the size of the moon and the distance from the Earth. You notice in a total eclipse, from our perspective, the moon, the disk of the moon, is the same size as the disk of the sun. They fit right over each other. Now, whether that is a matter of geometry and harmonics, and it naturally happens that way, that's a possibility. But also the motions that the ancients were talking about being in place, the units of measure they were talking about, were so regular to look as if somebody had deliberately set up a dynamic that was attuned to certain numbers. The problem is we don't have any evidence as to who that might have been. It's theoretically possible that a non-human group that came from another planet would have the capability of doing something like that. It might have done it deliberately to foster life on a planet that didn't have it.
That's possible. Final calls here, Dave in Cleveland. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, remember they discovered all those canals that are all dry on Mars?
Yes.
And like you were mentioning about Venus maybe becoming the future Earth, just like we were the past Mars. At one time, Mars was just like the Earth. Probably had lots of life there. Right or wrong?
What do you think of that, Laird?
That could be. I mean, Velikovsky was one of the people who said they were going to find water on Mars, and they did. He even said they were going to find water on the moon, which they've done.
Which they've done.
And even his closest advisors and closest proponents said he was wrong about that one, and he was right. I think that there are signs that Mars might have harbored life back in ancient times.
Yeah, something horrible happened to that planet.
Right.
I mean, just catastrophic, to be sure. And, you know, some say that the Martians came here.
Right. I mean, and that would make sense. If you knew that catastrophe was about to happen, you would try to go someplace else.
Carl in Columbus, Ohio. Final caller. Go ahead, Carl.
Hi. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thanks for Carl.
Taking my call.
Sure thing.
I am a firm believer in other life outside of our planet because I believe that I have had an encounter with them.
Ooh, really? What happened?
About 8 years ago, I believe I was abducted.
Well, you might have been. You know, we can't refute that by any means.
Right. I mean, you're not the only person who's been reporting that. So makes sense to pay attention to what your experience was and try to compare it to what other people's experiences have been and try to make sense of it.
Maybe on open lines, Carl, when we have a little more time, call us and tell us what you think happened to you because you are not alone when it comes to things like that. Laird, only have about a minute left, and I would like to give you the final word, my friend. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I think there's a lot here in this field of study to be turned up. I have a lot of friends who are researchers who are doing very good work, and now it looks like the big finds are going to come from comparing notes with each other. I'm trying to set up a day of instruction potentially some point in the future in the Hudson Valley where Ed Nightingale, my friend who has written about the Giza Plateau, and I may conduct a class, a day's worth of classes. So we're his idea is to try to bring groups of researchers into the same place to compare notes on certain subjects and see what we can leverage from the different perspectives.
Is your work controversial, in your opinion?
Absolutely. There's no traditional researcher who endorses what I say at all, but I can defend every piece of it.
Do they go crazy when they hear you?
No, because this is the realm of discussion where they can just poo-poo it and there's no consequence for them. So my perspective is the group of researchers I'm working with are making their own progress. Eventually, that progress, well, if it proves to be right, is going to draw the traditional researchers into it.
Laird, thanks for being on the program. Do keep in touch, okay?
Thank you very much for having me on, George.
Laird Scranton. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesure, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.